I'm Mark Brazell. Thanks for listening to the Book Club at 91.7 here on WVXU. Al Capone may have been famous during Prohibition with all his escapades, but let me tell you, there was another bootlegging empire in Iowa that held its own. And the story of that bootlegging empire is shared in the new book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. It was written by Bryce T. Bauer, who's joining me on the phone from his home in New York City. Bryce, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
To begin with, I saw in your bio in the back of the book that you grew up about 15 miles from Templeton, the city at the center of this book. Did you grow up hearing tales of this bootlegging empire there in rural Iowa?
Yeah, I did. You know, I heard about them since I was a pretty young kid from a family friend of ours named Louis Lauritsen, who used to be fond of Templeton Rye and would tell all of the Prohibition era stories around it.
Well, Templeton Rye, let's begin by introducing how Templeton Rye came about, beginning with the man who came up with the mash recipe, a man with the unlikely name and Ohio roots to boot, Herbert Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me
mm-hmm.
about Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, Herbert Hoover was a jovial blacksmith, I think is the best way to capture who he was. And he got to tinkering and, you know, wanted to drink when Prohibition was coming. He got to tinkering and he developed his own still because he was a blacksmith. He could make that. And he also developed a recipe that became the famous Templeton Rye.
And what was the secret of the Templeton Rye recipe?
The secret was a lot of things. It was mostly that there was this focus on quality in Templeton. But there was also the rye aspect was pretty unique. Rye had been a popular drink earlier in America's drinking history, but it's kind of started to fade for a while. But by putting rye back in, it was really harkening back to that tradition.
Now, this is a Templeton, Iowa, a population of, I think, what was it, 428 at the time. Rural, very German Catholic, and this was coming off the tail end of World War I, where many of those German Americans were suffering from, I guess you could say, negative press. And how did that work into your story? Because you do spend quite a bit of time talking about that German American experience around that time in the late teens and 1920s.
Yeah, that was really key to the story because the German Americans, Germany was, of course, our enemy. And the German Americans were really persecuted quite a lot. And it really brought them together. Standing up to that persecution brought the community of Templeton together. And also, you know, I think lowered a little bit their respect to this new prohibition law. They had been kind of ostracized for so long during the war that when Prohibition came into being at the end of the war, it was kind of, to them, a question of why follow this? Why follow this silly little law that you have now put up on us?
Well, you talk about them suffering from discrimination. You talk about a near lynching of two residents, and it would seem that, was there a constant battle going on, or did the German-American population in the area outstrap the other population?
Well, around Templeton, it was so many German Americans that the persecution really they were able to outstrap them there. But the lynching happened in a county to the south called Ottawa County, which is actually where I'm from. And that was a much more mixed county. The German American population was much smaller there. And there was a number of violent incidents and hate against German Americans in that county, and pushed some of them toward Templeton.
I'm speaking with Bryce T. Bauer. He wrote the book Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. You can learn more about it at wvxu.org. And this really was, I don't know if you'd call it a conspiracy, Bryce, but you're talking that you had farmers, you had merchants, you had the doctor, the town doctor, even a church official involved. How did that bootlegging operation all begin in Templeton, Iowa, back in the 1920s?
Well, the bootlegging operation started kind of small. You know, with the start of Prohibition, people still wanted their drink. And these were farmers. They got a hold of Herbert Hoover's recipe, got a hold. He made some stills for a lot of people and shared that still design with other blacksmiths in the area. And people started making it for themselves. But slowly word got round that, hey, this is really good whiskey. And demand from outside the community really started to take hold, and people started to scale up their production. And eventually a man named Joe Erlbeck, who is kind of the kingpin there, he was, you know, in his 20s at the time, just a few, almost the same age as Al Capone, actually. And he came in and kind of organized everybody into this conspiracy, into a syndicate of sorts. And to do so, he had to get everybody involved in the community, and they all had various roles to play. And that's when it really started becoming big and started being distributed around the Midwest.
But it, of course, was facing oppositions because for every quote-unquote bad guy, there is a good guy. Introduce us to the revenuer, if you may, who pursued the bootleggers of Templeton.
Yeah, the bootleggers of Templeton had a real nemesis in a gentleman named Benjamin Franklin Wilson, who had been a sheriff of Audubon County, the one where there was a lot of anti-German sentiment, and where I'm from, for quite a while. And he was really an ardent hater of alcohol. So when Prohibition started, he quickly signed up to join the new Prohibition Bureau to enforce these laws, and stayed with it throughout Prohibition as one of the few actually honest officers in the Bureau. And he really spent a lot of his time investigating and raiding the bootleggers of Templeton.
Well, I found it fascinating. He knew early on that something must be developing in Templeton because he noted that there were three stills that had been seized in raids that were almost identical to each other, and he knew there must be something afoot there in Templeton.
Yeah, he made an early connection with that this wasn't just a few guys, you know, doing it on their own in the back of their house or whatever. He was the one, he really noticed pretty quickly that, hey, this is an organized thing, and it's a thing that's organized and the okay has been given by town officials and by more officials with the church Monsignor, who said this was okay as well.
Well, and it's interesting that the doctor I mentioned earlier, who was in on the conspiracy, made sure that the town water would be turned on at midnight so that the bootleggers could fill up their stills to start cooking, from what I understand.
Yes, he became the mayor of the town and was always a big supporter of one of his town's big economic engines at the time. And also a man who is very, Doc Morgenthaler, and he was also a man who was very fond of drink himself.
Well, I have to go back to Joe Erlbeck, who you said, the Beck, as he came to be called, who was the ringleader who organized it all. And he kind of went off on it because when Prohibition hit and he found someone with some bootleg whiskey, they were asking $10 a bottle, and he figured that was $2 each for each of his friends, and he would either go broke or just have to quit drinking. And that's why he decided to go into the business, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He was a farmhand at the time, and farmhands weren't too well paid. They were, you know, paid mostly in room and board and just a little bit of pocket change. And booze prices skyrocketed, as you would expect, when Prohibition began. And he realized that he could no longer afford to have a couple of drinks on a Friday night and enjoy himself. So the only solution he saw was to start making it, and quickly found, you know, an entire business that grew into Templeton Rye.
So share with us how far Templeton Rye went, how big an influence it had during the Prohibition era, because it became, even in speakeasies, people would ask specifically for Templeton Rye, and it seems that would be dangerous if you're trying to keep things undercover.
Yeah, I think it ended up being a little dangerous for them, but it became in Iowa and states kind of around it a brand name, in the sense that people weren't asking for just a drink. They would specifically ask for Templeton Rye because it had kind of accreted this reputation of a quality drink, of a drink that was safe and tasty. And it got known, you know, it was constantly in the newspapers in Iowa. It was mentioned a lot. It was being ran, Joe Erlbeck talks about a runner that would take it to Denver. There's occasional mentions of it in Chicago. So it kind of got all over the Midwest and took on that brand name.
Well, how did it avoid being involved with gangsters like Al Capone, or you know, what was the involvement when it came to organized crime and the bootlegging in Templeton?
For the most part, the violence stayed out of Templeton. It was one of the remarkable aspects of the story and something that drew me so much to it, because it was such a small community, and it was a community that was really oriented around bettering itself and not so much prone to infighting because everybody was so close. But there were some dealings with gangsters, the main one being a guy named Kenneth Sonderleiter, who was the kingpin in Des Moines and was responsible for all of the booze distribution there. And Sonderleiter wasn't the most savory character. He was prone to fighting and disagreements with people. And he had connections with people in Capone's organization and kind of gangsters throughout the Midwest. But he kind of was a stopgap, and a lot of that violence stayed out of, all of that violence stayed out of Templeton.
You mentioned you grew up hearing stories about Templeton and these days during Prohibition, but when you did the research for your book, Gentlemen Bootleggers, did you find anything surprising or just have those stories pretty much affirmed?
It was all surprising, I have to say. You know, I didn't know before really researching this book how richly the story connected to themes like the German-American experience during the First World War and to kind of the urban-rural split. And I had no idea also that there were people out there like Joe Erlbeck who had made such a big operation out of it. I also had no idea that it was something that was talked about in newspapers to the extent that it was. It was something that was popularly known. I'd always kind of just thought it was, you know, famous in the area and famous by a few drinkers outside of the area. But I didn't know that it was such a common name throughout the Midwest during Prohibition.
So did you have any of your relatives who were involved in this these going-ons?
Not that I'm aware of. My relatives were pretty straight-laced. They tended to be more Methodist ministers than bootleggers. So no one that I know.
Well, you're working on a film for this, right? A documentary? You're co-producing and co-writing a documentary about this?
Yes. It's a documentary called Whiskey Cookers, and it's been released this summer.
Excellent. Well, interesting story, and thank you for bringing it to light, Bryce.
Well, thanks for your interest in it.
Bryce D. Bauer, his book is Gentlemen Bootleggers, The True Story of Templeton Rye, Prohibition, and a Small Town in Cahoots. It's available where books are sold and at local libraries. You can learn more at wvxu.org. It's the Book Club at 91.7.